Hello and welcome to the very 293rd episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, the podcast all about board games, and the people who love to play board games.
That's me and you. Board games.
I'm Matt Lees and I'm joined by Tom Brewster.
I'm board games.
He's board games made incarnate.
It's true.
Put him on the pyre and set him alight so the board game boy may be born again, renewed.
That's very thematic, actually, if you were to burn me at the stake, because this episode, it's the violence special.
Oh, absolutely. We love violence here at Shut Up, Sit Down, and that's why we have got three games which are all incredibly violent.
Just brutal, gory, disgusting games.
We're going to be talking about bomb busters.
Oh, bombs.
Exactly. Bombs. They blow up things.
Yeah.
This is a game where you're some bunny rabbits defusing bombs. It's a cooperative family game. We're going to be talking about Neko Syndicate, a game about Yakuza, sort of gangs.
Blood, guts, gore. Oh,
but actually, it's the little cats,
right.
The little cats who make sushi, and they travel around town
sort
to get sushi to
tableau
people.
Tableau building cat game,
with sushi. And then we're going to be talking about Off With Their Heads.
Yo!
The guillotines.
Oh, the guillotine, the famous instrument of revolution.
Yeah, quite violent though. Quite violent, the guillotine, because it does involve chopping people's heads off.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's how it works.
Oh, okay. I thought it was for paper exclusively.
When you see that thing saying, this machine kills fascists, it's because it cuts their heads off.
Because it cuts their heads off, that's why they die.
Yeah, that's why they die. This is a game set in the world of like Wonderland's War style things. So it's about the Queen of Hearts from Alice in Wonderland saying off with their heads.
Right.
And it's a
bit
game.
Of a roll and write, right?
It's a kind of a flip and write. It's just very gentle. You're writing numbers on mushrooms.
Yeah.
And collecting friends to have a tea party with.
Yeah, it sounds really violent.
Oh, it's actually there's no implication of violence at all apart from the name.
Oh, okay.
Violence!
First up on the podcast, Matt, you are going to tell me about Neko Syndicate, a 2024 game designed by Danny Garcia with art by Jennifer Geiner and published by Combo Games and more, according to Board Game Geek.
Yeah, I'm sure, and more. I'm sure there's more to than meets the eye. This is a game I heard some nice things about, so I want to check it out. And it was a really delightful, tight, small box tableau builder.
Oh yeah.
The idea of the game is that the old master of the gang is retiring, and you're going to decide who is going to take over the gang, and you're going to do that by proving that you're really good at delivering sushi.
You're excellent at tableau building.
Yeah. The implication that you're all in a gang doesn't seem to stretch beyond the fact that you've got these cute cartoon cats who have like tattoos and knives. But again, like the knives are probably for cutting up fish.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real implication of violence in this game at all, actually. Which is a shame. I don't know how this one slipped into the episode. I apologize.
Bodes very poorly for the violence special.
I'm sure there'll be loads of violence in the other ones. Don't worry about it. The way this game works is you're kind of simultaneously running your little tableau engines. And at the start of the game, you just have the top of your pyramid, as with any good gang structure. and the way it works is that on your turn, you have your little like cat piece character for your faction, and then you're going to move them down this track. And each card that you land on, you're going to get to activate one of two powers on it. So you have like the ability to maybe create some sushi
out of thin air,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you got something that allows you to do moving sushi around.
Whoa, like, or a conveyor belt?
Maybe just cubes walking around town like nobody's business.
With real legs?
Yeah, I guess so. Why not? Why not? Mm. It's abstract. I can imagine that if I want to and you can't stop me. Maybe you have the ability to use an underground system.
Wow.
Which allows you, again, to transport cubes of sushi.
Sushi pipes.
Around the world more quickly, because here's the clever thing: after you've done an action on a card, and each card has two actions, one on the other side you can choose, you then move down to the next level, and this is the point where you have to choose, do you want to go left or right? And as the game goes on, you're going to be placing more cards to build out your tableau, but then this tableau, you don't run everything, you run a bit of it each time.
Okay.
So you move down from the first level to the second level, and then the second level to the third level, and you're zigzagging down and moving diagonally down one space, which means if at the start of the game you decide on this round to go left and down at the start instead of right and down, then it means you're not going to be able to go and use actions that you might have placed at the bottom right-hand side of the pyramid, because you just can't walk over there.
Right.
You're going to step down a maximum of four times, and then at the end of the round, you're going to reset.
Yeah.
The funkiness of this puzzle comes in the fact that when you are placing these new location cards into your gradual pyramid that goes down, the locations you place them in are pretty important because the level that the card is on, so if you put things on the bottom level of the pyramid, it can be a maximum of 4 levels down. Mm. The actions in those spaces are going to be quadrupled.
Right.
So it means that like you're putting something down the bottom and it means that like this card, when you land on it, is going to be real powerful.
Right. But the chance you're going to get it is lower because you have to be very specific in your routing if you want to get to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas like the ones higher up in the pyramid, you're going to be using more frequently.
Yeah.
The other thing is that each of these cards, when you're choosing them, doesn't just have actions on them. They also have like sushi slots. Mm-hmm. So they have little different types of sushi cafes that you have to fill up with fish. Mm-hmm. And if you fill up those requirements and you put those cubes onto those little sushi shops and you get it all done nicely and correctly, you're going to get bonus points and you're going to get more points for cards that are higher.
Right. Okay. Okay.
So you have a situation immediately whereby, let's just say you have a card that requires 3 bits of tuna and 1 bit of salmon mm-hmm. at the top. You mm-hmm. think, okay, well, if I do that, then that's going to be worth like 5 points in total with the bonuses times 4.
Wow.
That's 20 points.
So many points.
But Tom, But if you want to make the sushi cubes, it's going to take forever to make sushi cubes high up in the pyramid because they're only going to make like you land on that and it's going to make 2. Whereas if you can put it right at the bottom and you can make a little juicy, every time you activate it, you make 4 tuna cubes, right? Whoa, that's business. The issue then though is moving those cubes up the pyramid is more expensive. You need movement actions to move them. And each card is split into 2 halves. So you have like 2 bits of district on it,
which means sushi delivery bay.
Which means even moving a sushi up into the next card is going to require 2 movement if it's made at the bottom.
Yeah.
So then you need like 4 movement to move 4 cubes 1 space. Nightmare.
So why not just fill your boots with sushi at the bottom of your pyramid?
Well, then you might, and you might just fill up those because you're not getting fewer points. You're only getting 1 point for each point, whereas you get 4 points for each point at the top. So there's a fun puzzle of trying to work out like where to put your juicy cards mm-hmm. and being like, okay, well, this card is going to be really useful at the bottom, but if I put it nearer the top, then it's going to get me way more points at the end of the game.
It's like it's going to be more like efficient to put it at the bottom, but it's going to score me more points higher up.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And then you're also trying to think about the kind of paths you're building, right? Mm. Because as you say, if you put something at the bottom, it might be perfect now. It might do something really useful for you this round. But like, are you realistically going to be going and using that again? Like, where can you put things so that you can create a little thread that you might reliably be able to keep using?
Yeah, or if you put something near the top, I guess it's like, you like that action now, but do you like it every single round?
Exactly.
And how do you build out this like pyramid of cards? Like, do you build it out like 1 card at a time per round?
Yes. So basically, on your turn, at the very start, you choose whether to like basically add some new cards to your draw pile mm-hmm. or to just draw cards and play them. Mm. So effectively, every now and then you have to take a round where you're like, I haven't got enough cards. I mm-hmm. need to draw some more in. But if you want to, you can spend a few turns not improving the size of your pyramid to really dig through and try and find the exact cards you want. So you've got a bit of a choice of being like, do I just make do with what I have in my hand? Mm. Or do I potentially slow down my game and let other people run away with things a bit more to dig through that deck and find things to make myself a really optimal little pathway?
Do you ever get to a point where you get to remove parts of that pyramid, or are they glued down?
They are glued down forever. Oh. And the game, you know, at the end of the game, if you haven't got, you get bonuses for like, you know, having filled things up.
Yeah.
But really, ideally, at the end of the game, you want to have filled out your entire pyramid space and you want to have fulfilled all of the sushi orders. Here's another thing that's slightly mean.
Oh my God.
At the start of the game, you have like your own personal pile of sushi cubes, mm-hmm. right? Which means you're not drawing them from some big like collection.
Communal supply, as is common in games.
As is common in games.
In sushi movement games.
In this one, no.
No.
You have a certain number and you have like 8 of each cube.
Right.
Let's just say. So I've got 8 salmon cubes. Mm-hmm. That means that if I put out too many cards that require salmon fulfillment, I just can't fulfill them all.
Because there's only so much salmon in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
I was really hoping what you were going to say is you can steal someone else's salmon.
Nope.
That was, but no.
Nope.
Take notes, designers.
This
you should be able to steal other people's salmon.
No, you're not wrong. This is a fairly solitary sort of thing.
Sure.
You also play simultaneously, though, which is nice. Mm,
that's nice for something that's like a bit of a thinky, puzzly, fillery type game.
I mean, like, I don't even know fillery. It's pretty crunchy.
Right.
It's a small box, but like this really had us brain burning. Mm. And it, to the extent that like it actually had a really, it's a really small detail, style, but it's something I really loved, which I think would be valuable with more players. It has a thing where the basically the deck that you then draw cards from to like add new things into the game at the start of each round, you have a thing where you, once you've finished your round and you've moved your little character all the way down to the bottom and you've done all your actions, the card backs have little slots for each of the different player pieces. So the idea is you just then place your, there's like a little slot for you to place your color piece on the deck of cards to show that you're done. Which
That's
means
really
basically
cute.
You then don't, you know that the round is done when they're all there.
Yeah.
And then everyone can take them back and then you draw cards from that place. And I just thought that was such a lovely bit of game design.
Yeah. That's really sweet.
It's like signposting not only in a visual clear place, I'm done, but also then it's directing you to the place where you then next go.
Yeah. And obstructing that place as well so that no one's going to draw cards beforehand. Because they have to move things out of the way.
Exactly.
That's really smart.
I was like, that's really cool. I love that. The other thing I loved is the fact that one of the actions you can do allows you to like literally just swap out one piece of fish from somewhere on the board that you haven't already served in a sushi cafe with one from your supply, which means you have a lovely mechanic of not just like, okay, well, I'm going to get loads of fish here and I hate to get them over here, but maybe actually like purposefully getting lots of one fish and then changing them for another one and having this weird balancing later in the game, balancing what fish are even available and getting to a point where you're like, yeah, I can make tons of salmon, but that's no good to me anymore because I can't make any more salmon. All the salmon's out.
All the salmon's gone.
So like maybe I start trying to convert my salmon into tuna so then I can make more salmon and convert something else.
In some unholy transfusion process.
Then, as I mentioned, you've got the underground system. You've got like A, B, C, and D marked on these cards that then means you go, okay, well, I can immediately transport cubes from any A card to any A card,
right,
which again affects how you're placing these cards. You don't want to have two Bs next to each other.
No.
Because that's a waste of a perfectly...
nice diverse network.
Yeah. You want to have like a plan. Honestly...
this looks cute.
It's cute and it's hella crunchy. I really enjoyed the fact that also you have these like shared objectives you have to try and do, and that classic thing of like, the first player did
like a
get
race
this?
To do them first.
But rather than it being a race to them first, it's a race to do them quickest. So the round tracker, play with 10 rounds, it moves along, and when you achieve it, you put one of your markers on that space and you get more points for achieving it earlier in the game. And it's exponential, which means that like, if we both achieve an objective in the same round, we both get the same amount of points.
Oh, okay, okay.
But otherwise, it's not as simple as I get 5 points and you get three.
Yeah.
It's like, I might get 15 points and you might get two. Just because like if you can do it real fast, you get rewarded
for
it.
You can push everything into getting a tuna delivered now. That's points.
It felt like a game which had like a lot of spaces to like really like crunch and play in interesting ways and really encourage you to be like, hey, like go crazy, do something wild
here. I love something that refines that kind of like, it's a pick up and deliver game, it's a logistics game, and I like when games kind of tilt into that fully, right? And this really seems like it's doing that. It's just, here is a complicated logistics puzzle, solve it.
Like, I don't know if I want to play it with lots of people, even though it is simultaneous. I can't tell, it might be like just a bit too sludgy.
Yeah, simultaneous with an asterisk, though, because it's like, I feel like a game being simultaneous is still as slow as your slowest player.
Exactly.
So it could, like, I don't know, in games that I've played relatively recently, I feel like my turns are very quick and one person's are incredibly slow.
You might have to put a taser underneath the chair of somebody.
Yes. As we recommend with most games, especially in the Violence Special.
Yeah, the Violence Special is all about that. And I mean, I think, you know, it's nice at least you have this card to put your pieces on, because maybe there could be a bit of a Magic Maze vibe there where like everyone's just staring at
one
player.
We're all done.
Like everyone just pointing at the card. No, I enjoyed it an awful lot. And I think that it says a lot that this is ostensibly a small box game about cute cats doing sushi. And my immediate thought after playing it was, I think Tom would really like this. Because I just think tonally, it's just really not the kind of vibe I'd expect you gravitating towards.
Yeah.
But the mechanics and how like tight and sharp it was, I was like, this is Tom's vibe.
Any game that's like in any way close to like running a business, it gets my brain going. And I feel like moving cubes from point A to point B, that's running a business.
It's very satisfying. Book. Very satisfying.
Very good. Next up in the Violence Special.
Whoa!
I'm going to tell you about Bombusters, Matt. I've been playing a bunch of this recently because I reviewed Take Time, a lovely co-op that you also played a bit of at PAX Unplugged.
Clocks.
I went away and reviewed some more of that clock business.
Honestly, that should have been the Violence Special, because there's nothing more violent than the ravages of time.
Wow. Damn.
Yeah.
It do be healing all wounds, but it also be killing people daily.
It only heals all wounds because it turns wounds to dust.
Wow.
No wound now. Psych.
This is a game designed by Hisashi Hiyashi with art by Dominique Ferland and published by Pegasus Spieler.
Mm.
And it's a game about bomb defusal.
Yeah.
We found it a lot funnier to roleplay in the space where you're making the bombs and you're trying to make them explode.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bomb defusal element of it, when I played it, it didn't really shine through. There wasn't like a real sense of tension in the room.
Oh.
But it was tension of the game, but not like I wasn't worried about a bomb going off.
Okay. Yeah, you need a real bomb for that, I think.
Yeah. That's what I recommend.
The more of this I've played, the more I've found it to be a real nail biter and a real like tense experience where everyone afterwards goes, oh. The reason that I really want to talk about this is because I asked for a copy of this game when I was talking about Take Time,
mm-hmm.
hoping to talk about it at the end where we do some alternative recommendations, because I thought that Bombusters will be a good pick. Turns out it is. I think this is a really good game for people who like Take Time or want a co-op game in their life that is this level of tense and crunchy. It's very good. So the way this game works is you have a rack of these little wire tiles in front of you, and all you are going to do is try and get rid of all of those tiles. The way you do this is by pointing at someone else's row of tiles and saying, is this an 8? Or is this a 1? Or is this a 2? Because the tiles go from 1 through 12, and they will be arranged on people's board in numerical order.
Yeah.
So you can make guesses or, more importantly, deductions as to what someone's number might be.
Yeah.
So I point at one of your tiles and I go, is this an 8? And you go, yes.
Yeah.
And you reveal it. And then I go, whew, I've got an 8 too. And I reveal an 8 from mine. And then we've cut 2 of the 8s.
Yeah. And so hopefully we've managed to do that because like on our little things, we've maybe got a 7 and a 9 revealed.
Yes.
And there's one in the middle. And you go, well that's probably
I
that.
That could be. But it could be another 7 could or it could be a 9. Ah, because there's 4 of each wire. So you never... Well, you do at some point truly know what wires are, but there's a lot of like calculated guessing or deductions or using some of the tools you have at your disposal to narrow your guess down to a precise digit. And then the game gets more and more complex.
It gets funkified pretty fast.
Really fast. The first thing that it introduces, which kind of makes the game like work, are these yellow and red wires.
Mm-hmm.
Yellow wires have a number like it'll be 7.1 or something like that. And the only way you can cut them is if you can identify where another yellow wire is. So you don't care about their number, you just need to know that another one is yellow. And then there are red wires, which if you ever snip them, you just lose the whole game.
Yeah.
So the only way of trying to get those snipped is by kind of slowly winnowing out every other wire on someone's board, so they only have the red one left, and they can go, ah, the red wire, I've snipped it, it's done.
Yep.
And you know roughly where these wires are? Because you can have situations where you know what the red wire is. You know it's like a 7.5, so you know it's going to mess up your deductions between 7 and 8. Or you might play a scenario where it's a little bit more vague about where those specific wires are located, which is where things get really mucky.
Yeah.
You've got all these like tools you can use to help you, like double detectors that let you kind of ask broader questions, or radars that let you ask for specific numbers around the whole table, or something like coffee that does something, or walkie-talkies that let you swap wires.
You start to have a sense where like everyone on the table is looking at maybe one or two players and being like, one of those two is the person we're looking for, but we don't know exactly which one, sort of thing.
And you have these tools to like get you out of those binds so that you almost never have to make a guess. There's almost always a thing you can do. And the thing that I really like about this, that I like about games, like I know that you're a Hanabi hater, but it's a thing that I like.
I just hate fireworks and happiness.
Yeah, that's understandable. Yeah. I like fireworks, and I do also like happiness.
And you know, I like both those things as well. So I don't know why I'm such a dick when it
when it comes to
when
Hanabi.
It comes to Hanabi and other things.
It's
but
your
anyway.
Naysay. It's your naysay. We're all allowed a few of them.
Yeah.
But Hanabi has this really interesting thing where the more you play it, the more you develop these like little heuristics for like how you can deduce things without directly asking about them, or ways of becoming just slowly more and more efficient at the puzzle. And Bombusters has these like 8 training missions, and over the course of those training missions, which are really satisfying bits of game
themselves,
by the end of those you have developed this like very basic toolkit for like the more advanced deductions you need to get onto the main game, which are these 66 different levels of ascending complexity that add in all kinds of weird new mechanics. So very brief, it's not real spoilers, but I'll give you like the very first one of these. This is literally like mission one, so don't worry too much about having too much revealed to you here.
Because you've got another 65.
You've got so many of them left. The very first one is like, it will say you have to cut these wires in sequence. So you've got to cut all the nines before you can cut all the twos, before you can cut all the threes, for example. So you have to kind of route your puzzling in a slightly strange or maybe kind of inconvenient way. And they add new equipment, they add little stickers, all kinds of fun little stuff, but they're all standalone, so you can, I think, question mark, citation needed, you can basically reset the game so that you can play through all those levels again.
Also with this stuff, like, if you're careful, you can. Like, I think that's often the case of, like, unless it's telling you to tear up things or destroy them, like, you can, if you do it in a way that, if you really care about that, then you can be mindful about it and you can do it in a way that will work.
It does say that you need to explode each box after finishing it, as is the theme of the game.
Sick.
To detonate it.
Yeah.
One of the things I really like, this is neither here nor there for actual quality of the game stuff, but you get this tiny little standee of a little proud-looking bomb buster figure, and it says, this figure will not be used until mission 66, which I think is delightful. It gives it to you in mission one, and he just hangs out for the whole game, and then he comes into use in the very last mission, which I think is really funny.
It's like he's been there all along.
He's been watching over us.
It's a bit like that lovely...
maybe he's the main villain. Oh my God,
The lovely moment in the game we worked on, Wilmot's Warehouse, the tile that's like, hide this tile somewhere in the room.
Yeah.
And then you just forget about it, and then you're like, oh,
there it is.
It's over there.
Ta-da! I really like Bombusters. The more of this I play, the more I really appreciate the puzzle at the core of it. And I think it's kind of wrapped in this gorgeous, like, cute art style that I think really sings.
It's deeply charming.
It's so charming. Like, all the little Bombusters you can play as, they're real sweet looking. And the puzzle itself is just delightful. It's a really, really fun puzzle, and it's really tense because you are not allowed to communicate. Of course, any information that isn't, like, there's some things that you are allowed to say if it's like basically really obvious, but you're not allowed to make deductions on other people's behalfs to prevent quarterbacking. And there are so many moments where the whole table is going, like, oh my God, don't do it, we all know, but you don't.
And you're just waiting for the penny to drop, and it's so nice when it does, and you go, they just go, oh, and you're like, yes.
And there's all these, like, so one of the things that happens early on is that everyone gets to label like a little bit of their own rack of tiles. They get to say, this one is a 5 or something like that. You give away a little bit of information, and it's so interesting seeing how people start to use that information in like novel ways and can like manipulate it. Or there's ways in which, like, early on, if you see 2 of the 12s have been cut and you have the other 2 12s, well, why not just reveal them, right? Like, that's a turn. But then you realize you can use your turn in more useful ways than just revealing information that everyone can deduce.
Yeah.
And you slowly create this kind of like shared understanding of like when you should be making deductions and when you should use your turn to just go, I can't make any deductions right now, I'll just reveal the information we all know.
Which in itself is like, you know,
is information. It's one of those puzzles that initially seems really, really, really hard, and then the more you play it, you develop all these little ways into it that are really delightful.
You learn the actual job.
You
of
learn
being
the real job of being a bomb buster.
I mean, I had a great time with this, and I only played through really the tutorials, which again, usually these days when I see a campaign game, I don't want to do the tutorials because I think it's going to be boring. But these were great.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, a very exciting box. It actually sounds a lot when you're describing it, like, it has a lot in common with, like, The Crew. In terms of, like, the way you have these very simple tools for doing things and giving information, and you start to learn how you can, like, without abusing the rules of the game, be using these in ways that, like, kind of go, okay, I kind of think I know what that means.
You can just bend them like ever so slightly to kind of like pull information out of what seems like a really inert system to begin with. You kind of think, how are we ever meant to get this right? And then you realize, oh, there's loads of little ways, little tells that you can find your way in. I don't have much more to say about Bombusters. I just think it's really solid.
Yeah.
It's a really good game, and I can't wait to play more of it.
Yeah.
I really want to finish it. I want to play all those boxes, which is crazy.
You want to find out what the 66th bunny person is?
Yeah,
four.
I really, really want to know. I want to know what all the twists are, because already the twists are pretty nasty.
I'd love it if it's like you
some
get
of those
to
boxes
mission
are really big,
and it's like, put the bunny in your mouth.
Put the
bunny in your mouth.
Violence.
End of the game. Finally, on today's podcast, we're going to be talking about Off With Their Heads.
Whooshing! This is a game designed by J.B. Howell and Michael Mailsick, with art by Manny Tremblay and published by Druid City Games.
Now, this is a game that really took me by surprise in the fact that I'd almost given up on finding a new roll and write, flip and fill style game that actually felt different and felt like unique. And I think that the ones that I've found that I actually like have gelled with most have been the ones that just go all out on the mechanical gritty. Things like, you know, Danshun Clever. Mm-hmm. Is that Danshun Clever?
Ganshun Clever.
Ganshun Clever. I knew
and
I was doing
Doppelt German. So Clever and all those kinds of games.
My spider sense was telling me I'd done German wrong and it was furious at me.
I feel like with roll and writes broadly, I feel like this sense that I like roll and writes as a category of game.
Yep.
But I don't have any strong feelings about a particular roll and write over another.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Like, they're all just like, when I want to play a roll and write, I'll play a roll and write. I'll have a really nice time.
Yeah.
But I'm never in a position where I'm like, oh, I really fancy specifically Fleet the Dice game over Ganshun Clever.
Well, I feel like there've been lots of different ones that have given the promise of like, oh, this is going to be different. This feels like, oh, this could be really different.
Like, and Tend maybe is a good example.
There was
that.
Definitely one with dinosaurs. I can't remember what it was.
Dinosaur Roar and Write.
It might have been. I can't remember. but I just remember there've been lots of times when my eyebrows and my face has gone, ooh. And then I've been like, it's like you say, it's a roll and write.
It's a roll and write.
It has the same thing. It's ticking the same space.
Perfectly pleasant.
This, however, actually does something different.
Wow.
In a way that I was like, this is a pretty neat game.
There's no rolling or writing or flipping or filling.
No.
Because it's an area control Euro game.
It is not.
Damn.
How dare you?
I thought I had it.
So effectively, yes, you have a sheet that you're filling in, right? Mm-hmm. And you're going to put numbers into a thing and then you're going to do things and you're going to get points. And you're going to be able to do combo things where you're filling a box and it lets you fill in another box for free. Wahoo!
Or ZZZ, Matt, I've played this game before.
Well, have you though, Tom? Have you?
Oh.
Because this game is a card game.
Oh.
Yeah.
I really haven't played this game.
Now, we were playing this in the two-player version of the game, and I think that's like slightly less ideal because it means that you're having to play kind of for an AI on the side as well. There's a slight randomization to the element setup of it. It'd be much more satisfying to play with three or more, but having said that, I play with two and I had a great time. The way it works is you have this hand of cards, and then each turn you're all going to play secretly a card. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to reveal all the cards, and then you're going to see who has won the setup.
Trick.
But it's kind of funky, and initially I was like, I don't know about this, but if it was a real cold hard trick taker, it wouldn't really work.
Okay.
Because the first thing is, yes, you're going to be looking for which of these cards is the highest, is the winner, which of these cards is the loser, and then you have cards in the middle. And those statuses affect where you get to draw on your sheet because you have a top, a middle, and a bottom on your sheet. And you can only play the number and the suit that you've played if in that area, if it matches that criteria.
Right. Okay.
So let's just say I play like a 12 of spades and mine's the best card.
12 of spades?
Yeah.
That's more spades than is normal.
It is more spades than is normal.
Hell.
These cards are not a normal deck of cards.
Yeah, it's
freaking
me out already. There's
some funky going on over here.
Ugh.
Right? I play that and then I get to go in the high spot, which means I have this top area of the board where I can put that number in a mushroom. And it has a rule where like I can't have two numbers matching in the same little mushroom. So I have to fill them up with different things, which already you'll see a little problem in. And the fact that like you'd think that to have the winning card of a round, you need to have a high number.
Right.
You're quite quickly going to have a problem where there aren't that many high numbers
for you to choose from. Because you need to both win or be the high card. And you need a number that's different to the one that you won last time with?
Yeah, okay. Probably.
Right.
However, you've then got red mushrooms and black mushrooms. And the suit of the card matters in so much as red and black. It doesn't have any more complexity than that. Mm-hmm. It's that if you want to fill in a red space, it has to be a red card. Mm-hmm. Black space, a black card. Mm. The thing that then makes it malleable and workable is the fact that you have a winning suit. And it's not just like a trump suit in the fact that like, oh, this round, the hearts are the trump suit. So any heart will be any other thing. Mm-hmm. It works in a circle for all of these suits. So you have a little standee of the Queen of Hearts who moves around this circle and it shows you which cards are going to be the most powerful and the weakest. Mm. And also lets you know straight away what's going to be the case next round.
Right.
So you go, okay, this round, hearts are trumps, which means like any heart, if I play a two of hearts, if no one else plays a heart, mine's the top card and it's a two. Mm-hmm. If not, then we go along to the next one. And it means that if there's any club, then any club is going to be any of the suits going on. And that means that if you play a low card of the suit that is currently the worst suit,
I see.
Then you're almost guaranteed to get that coveted lowest value. Uh-huh. Because you might not want to be getting highest all the time. Mm-mm. The different tracks you have are kind of interesting. The top one has these different coloured mushrooms, and you have some mushrooms where it's like half red and half black, which means you can choose to place them with either one. Other ones where you have to fill them up left to right with certain colours. The middle area is sort of a weird hodgepodge. It's a forest where you are rewarded for not having any numbers that are matching, touching each other, but it's not essential. Mm. You can be a little fuzzier there.
Right.
And you get bonuses for having certain clusters of trees surrounding points. But then it has a weird thing where like you get bonuses on the edge of the forest where you're not going to get as many points for doing that, but you might get some immediate pop-off bonuses that let you move these marks around or duplicate marks and do all of that stuff you'd expect.
And that sort of thing sounds like a lot like the kind of standard roll and write fare of like, make a nice sort of coherent set of numbers go up, tick off boxes.
Yep.
But then the other side of it is kind of, I suppose, a more like directly pointed bit of card play that's kind of, you're actively responding to your opponents.
Yes.
Which is quite a nice mix of the two.
Honestly, like I was gently very impressed by it in the fact that like it made me realize, oh, okay, actually, because you have this hand of cards and that's going to be, you're going to play three rounds, mm-hmm. but this hand of cards is going to be your entire round. Mm. It means you have to be selective about what you're playing when, but also like trying to work out like a plan for the round. What am I trying to do here? Mm-hmm. Because what we realized when we played the first game of it, and the reason we played it again straight away afterwards, always a good sign, and at the end of the second game I would have played it again, frankly. Mm. It was great.
Right.
Was the fact that you get to the end of the game and you think, gosh, I really haven't filled in nearly as much of the sheet as I was expecting to.
Like, sure.
I was expecting to have filled up most of it, not optimally.
Yes.
But actually, I was like, you've gone a bit of everywhere.
You have to be kind of selective.
And you haven't really done everything.
Right.
So then you have a thing where you go, well, actually, you want to kind of go all in.
Right.
And you want to be like, I want to try and do all of the top or all of the middle or all of the bottom.
I want to win like crazy.
And that becomes then a real puzzle of with the cards I have, how can I do this with those cards?
Yeah.
Particularly as then in the second and third round, you are having to then roll with what you've, a decision you've kind of already made of then getting a hand of cards. And this is where I thought you'd really like it again, of being a horrible tickle, of being like, how am I going to lose consistency with this? And that's where the fact that you have this like circling trump order
really
becomes very important. Of you being like, okay, well, then I can play this, then I can play this. And we found that once we got the game, it became brutal, where you would have it kept being rounds where I'd be like, okay, and I'm going to play the three of spades, with the spades being the worst suit. Mm-hmm. And then the other player flips over and they've played the two of spades. And you're like, I'll kill you. Just like really like tight, like that's unfortunate, but really lovely moments.
Yeah. I think that sounds great.
It's like, honestly, like I was really, really enjoyed it. And I was really surprised because I was at this point thinking, I've seen what this kind of game is like, and like you, I'm not bored of it. I like it, but it doesn't surprise me. And this being the actual interaction here was fascinating, because like the bottom section of the map that you're filling in is like a labyrinth where you are filling in spaces to get further into it, and you start off with red on the left side and black on the other side, which means even with this, like to get to the center and to get the juicy bonuses, you have to not only be like losing, but you have to be losing with like the same color of card
frequently enough
to get through to the middle.
Which might get quite difficult.
Which gets tricky, right?
Stronger, yeah.
And we had a game where like if someone else is doing that, it becomes harder for you to do that, right? Because not only are they taking the losses on turns when you needed them, but like they're losing with red cards, which makes it harder for you to lose red cards probably because those cards are being used, and having that thing of maybe having to pivot and having to be like, I don't know if I'm going to do this again. I've not seen that level of interaction really.
Yeah, that's realize... what I was going to say is it seems like a really, like it's kind of solving, not the problems necessarily, but it's kind of providing an alternative to some of the things that people struggle with in roll and write games, and that it's deliberately more interactive, but also you're not ending at this point where you have like a board of stuff that you've just filled in all of. I always feel like some of the more like explosive spreadsheety roll and write games, I end up with just a completely full board, and I think, well, did the order of which I picked these things really matter?
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
Whereas having you sort of specialize in different parts of it each time, I think is really fascinating.
100%. And then there's all sorts of other little rubs and stuff here, and I think I've just remembered that I made the 14 thing maybe wrong. I think that might be one of the options you can do with the ace. You can either have 1 or 14. I can't remember exactly, but the spirit of the thing is there. And I really enjoyed the puzzle of it, and the way that it wasn't a solitary puzzle. It was something you had to be adaptive to and mindful of. And actually, one thing when I was reading the manual, it was almost like an inverse of a magic rule. Mm. You know, we talk about the magic rule of like you read a manual and you go, this is the whole thing that ties it together. And you go, I get it now. This could be interesting. I don't know what this was, but I read
it. It made it really boring.
No, I read it and I was like, okay, all right. Because it felt like a rule too far.
Okay.
When I was looking at it, I was like, come on now. This is too much. But I was wrong. Oh. I was real wrong. At the end of the game, what you do is you have your hand of cards, you play through, and then there's two cards each round that you do not play with. Mm-hmm. These two cards go face down to the side. They do not get shuffled back into the main deck for the next round.
Yeah.
And at the end, you take the six cards that you have there, and out of these six cards, you make the best poker hand you can.
Whoa.
Out of those six cards. And then you get points based on how good your poker hand is, and you get points if you have the best poker hand.
Right, okay.
And that was the point where I was like,
That's too much.
I was wrong. I was dead wrong. Not only is this a fantastic flourish at the end of the game to be like, you don't really know who's won it because you don't know what's going on, it also adds a very gentle element of like messing with people.
Yeah.
Whereas if you can see someone's doing something, like removing cards that you think are going to be helpful for them by just putting them to one side.
Yeah.
People are there like looking for an ace, you know, or something. And it's like, you're not going to find it because like I've put it over here.
That's great.
But then also making that choice when you have your hand of cards of being like, which cards do I want to use and which cards do I want to keep? Mm-hmm. Like the higher value cards are often better. Like on some places on the board, you're just getting more points for using higher numbers.
Yeah.
But then you're going to have a better full house.
Make such a sweet hand.
And like, cool. Again, just a lovely little constant decision. And I had a wonderful moment where I had these 2 8s at the side of my hand and I was going to make a full house with them. And then somewhere during the round, I forgot that I'd earmarked those 8s for that. And I used one of them. And then at the end of the game, it was like, revealed my hand of poker and I had nothing.
It's a full house-ish.
It's like, it would have been a full house if I hadn't forgotten and used my 8s. It's a full house, but
I left the front door open and the roof's falling in.
But again, it's just a nice decision, especially when you're like struggling, of being like, do I just forget about the poker hand and just try and do as well as I can? I was really impressed by this one. It took me by surprise.
Cool.
I was just disappointed at the lack of violence.
Yeah, just not enough violence in this one.
It's called off with their heads. There wasn't any implication of violence. I think it was just a reference to the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland.
Damn. I wanted to see real execution in this one.
Yeah.
What a shame.
Yeah, never mind. And that is all you get this week. You horrible, violence-obsessed gubbins. Oh, kids these days, they won't do anything unless it's got a Call of Duty in it.
Yeah. And of course, on this podcast, we did talk about Call of Duty. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10.
And next week, we'll be talking about Call of Duty 12, Tokyo Drift. Thank you very much for joining us. We think you're wonderful. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Goodbye.